As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, this is the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Hugh Wilson-Croft. Today, is it time Steve Bruce walks away from his beloved Newcastle United? Leicester City reached the FA Cup semis for the first time since 1982, but are they the real deal in 2021? After an up-and-down week at Tottenham Hotspur, has Jose Mourinho still got what it takes? And there is a huge moment to discuss for women's football as it goes free to air. We'll also look ahead to this week's international football. To help me through it all, Matt Dickinson, Alison Rudd and Gregor Robertson. Hi guys, how are you doing?
Hello.
True story.
I dreamt last night that Gylfi Sigurdsson took temporary charge of Everton as manager and they won 1-0.
Well, you're not going to tell us any more of the details? They just won 1-0?
Yeah, that was it. And because I was passing a shop window and I saw it through, like, you know, like you used to watch tellies in shop windows.
Mm-hmm.
That was the dream.
Have you had a COVID jab recently? Because I'm told that does make people have very strange dreams. There's one symptom.
Footballers' dreams, though, unfortunately for us lot, is not a rare thing. I think there is a spin-off somewhere in there just called Footballers' Dreams, where we tell the funny stories about the things that we've dreamt. Look, it's more of a nightmare at the moment for Steve Bruce at Newcastle United. He says he takes full responsibility after their 3-0 drubbing at Brighton. At Newcastle, 2 points above the drop zone, only 2 wins in their past 18 league games. Bruce says he will never walk away. Matt, if you love something, shouldn't you know when the right time is to end the pain?
Oh, getting this sort of, yes, romance gone wrong, are you saying? I find myself torn because, yeah, I mean, everything about form and performances suggests that, yeah, on this trajectory, Newcastle are doomed. Is it 2 wins out of 20 in all comps? Look at the table and, you know, they've just got their heads above water, but they're a team drowning at the moment. I'm torn between that sort of stark reality and I guess, to be honest, partly liking Steve Bruce whenever I've dealt with him, which is going back 20 or 30 years. I know that shouldn't, you know, won't come into it for Newcastle fans, but it does leave me, I don't know, a bit saddened by how personal it's got. You know, Newcastle fans will say that, you know, I've seen the banners, you know, there was the bust up recently with Richie and the Coward banner, and it is getting nasty, put it that way. And I just say, yeah, I find that a bit sad. You know, Steve, I think Steve Bruce has been trying his best, which isn't good enough at the moment, but he's been seen as Ashley's man, which obviously is never, you know, that never helps you in the eyes of the fans. And I saw one fan's website calling him a sort of fraudy Geordie. So that sort of personalizing of it is, but that's probably what the fans feel is the only way of getting through to Ashley, who is, you know, been tone deaf to the views of the fans for as long as he's been in charge at Newcastle.
No answer to the question, though. Do you think Steve Bruce needs to?
I mean, should he walk away? I don't necessarily think he should walk away. Is he going to, you know, should he be sacked? Well, clearly that's a fair question. And on current trajectory, they are looking like they're going to go down. I mean, if they can get a striker going, Callum Wilson getting injured is a big blow to that. Is their top scorer this season, but the failure to sort of use a striker and to present any sort of goal threat against Brighton was clearly the most obvious of many failings.
Alison, what do you think? Should he walk away if he loves the club so much?
Well, I think Newcastle fans have missed a trick here. If they don't like the manager, the way to get rid of him is to tell Ashley they think he's God. And then Ashley will do something. The whole history of Ashley's ownership at Newcastle is to be incredibly obstinate and to not listen to the fan voices and almost perversely ignore the popular route. So the more entrenched the nastiness which Matt outlined, and it is abhorrent really to have a go at one individual like that. But the bigger the flag, the nastier the language, the more entrenched the partnership between Ashley and Bruce will be. And it become every season almost, it becomes a sort of battle of will. And you can't help but think that Mike Ashley quite enjoys the sort of power trip of it. He's the man in charge. He owns the club. He makes the decisions. If he's happy dealing with the manager, he doesn't really care about much else. So, and also, it's all highly unproductive, all of this. It's that really Newcastle had no need to be in this relegation battle. But the more animosity there is around the club, the more negativity, the more you feel they're being sucked into it. So it's those that they keep creating stumbling blocks for themselves. It's utterly, utterly bizarre. And but I think it's a strange question, Hugh. You're sort of saying any manager who's failing, who has some sort of relationship with the club along the way, whether it's a childhood fan or just has become, you know, come to love the area he works in, has a duty to fall on his sword should things go wrong.
I think it's a unique situation at Newcastle personally. I mean, not just because Steve Bruce has that affinity to the club, and I wouldn't just say it because it's him either. He's working for someone who isn't going to move, and I think it's evident from the outside. A little bit like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer at Manchester United, who I'm sure we'll speak about a little bit later on. But when you know the club will relentlessly support you in the role, regardless of results, at some point you have to say, am I the man for the job? 2 wins in 18, you know Mike Ashley isn't going to do anything about your position. If Manchester United went and lost the next 5 games, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, I imagine, would know that Ed Woodward's not going to do anything about his position at Old Trafford. You know, that those are unique situations in football, given, I think, how readily some clubs sack their managers. So really, my point is, if you're at a club where the hierarchy are just so slow in moving, do you maybe have to do something about it? I don't know. Gregor, what do you think?
No. So it's very simple, I think. Look, there also, you've got to take into account Steve Bruce's kind of personal pride. He'll still believe somewhere deep down within him that he can turn this round, and he can, you know, he's had his back up against the wall many occasions before. He will still believe that somewhere deep down, I think. But so the question should be, should he be sacked? And the answer is yes. Because relationship between a manager and a club sometimes gets to a point where they are so, the manager is actually a hindrance rather than a help to the team. And that's not just because of the team he's picking, the style of football. It's just his presence is toxic now at the club. So it's not Steve Bruce because he's a Newcastle fan or he's from the area or anything. It's not on him to make that decision. It's on the owner, and it's just another failing of the owner, which is the biggest issue at Newcastle and has been for more than a decade. I don't much like the flags and stuff either. It's, you know, the vitriol of it, and particularly after the way his time at Aston Villa ended with a cabbage being hurled onto the pitch and whatnot. He said, you know, I think everyone in the media kind of thinks that Steve Bruce is a pretty decent guy, and he's had a tough time in recent years. But this game was also always going to highlight the kind of the malaise in Newcastle and the contrast between what a club who has some kind of plan and identity and sense of like adventure, even like Brighton, and this is Brighton and Hove Albion that we're contrasting with Newcastle United. You know, in the game, let's look at some of the stats. They had Newcastle had 3 touches in Brighton's box, 1 shot on target. Brighton had made 642 passes to Newcastle's 291. Like, we knew this all before, but it's still pretty stark when you see it there right in front of you, and the difference in the in those two teams and their style of play, and it, you know, I think it just kind of, that was the final straw for most Newcastle fans.
But that's, I mean, I think you wouldn't disagree with anything Greg has said there about, I mean, comparing, you know, when you talk about Brighton there, you're talking about Brighton, the club, aren't you? And you're talking about the, not just Potter, but what's built around him, and the fact that, you know, stuff is joined up. You know, you get a manager and you tailor your recruitment around them, not just that manager, but about what you think is a sustainable style. So if Potter left, that, you know, you'd be bringing in someone you hope with a similar ethos. And of course, you know, that's why the contrast with Newcastle is so stark, because, you know, we've seen through different managers that that doesn't come close to existing. Dubious appointments, in obviously very scattergun recruitment as well. So, you know, you can get rid of Bruce, but no one thinks that, you know, sorts out Newcastle, do they?
It might give a better chance of survival. That's the one thing you have to say now. Because as I say, it's toxic. His presence there is now a hindrance. So what have they got? How many games have they got left? 9 or something? I think they probably have a better chance of Premier League survival with someone else in the hot seat now.
Alisson, do they? Or is it too late for someone to turn the juggernaut around?
Are you suggesting that Sam Allardyce leaves West Brom and goes to Newcastle? Rafa Benitez would go in, wouldn't he? I mean, can you imagine what a fairy tale that would be for the Newcastle fans? Actually, I want that to now happen, because
could someone as good as Rafa Benitez, though, realistically, could even Rafa Benitez stop them on the trajectory they're on?
If, well, we're probably guessing, aren't we, how poisonous it is in training. We've had the leaked stories, and it doesn't sound like it's going very well, manager to players, they're not getting on. So if that is true, then someone coming in just to be different and to give them a boost and add a bit of stardust, if it was, it's not going to happen, but if it was someone like Rafa Benitez, then you'd think, well, they could do it. They're not bottom of the table. They've got a little bit of wriggle room here. I think they could. But I mean, what would be the more realistic thing would be Graham Jones would just step up into the fill the boots, and I don't know if that gives enough oomph of a sense of a change. I don't know. I mean, on balance, if it's true how poor things are on the training ground, then you have to say it might just give them a boost to take a few points where they wouldn't, and that might be all it needs to stay up.
Who knows with Newcastle United at the moment and Steve Bruce? I mean, I think it maybe is a little bit too late to move on. But that result against Brighton for me just shows you, I think, how the tables are turning for Newcastle. And I think maybe what has kept Steve Bruce in the job to this point in time is Fulham have stalled slightly. Had they won one or two games more and Newcastle had been in the bottom three for the past couple of weeks, and then they had this 3-0 defeat against Brighton, I think the calls would have been even louder sort of nationally than they are locally, if you know what I mean. But there you go. We'll see what happens with Steve Bruce in the coming weeks. Let's move from the Premier League to the FA Cup next. Of course, it was a split weekend. Leicester City have reached their first semi-final in 39 years. It was a 3-1 win over Manchester United. Alisson, when it comes to Leicester, can we stop talking about them as some sort of fairy tale story? Are they the real deal?
Well, that is so funny you say that, Hugh, because I think as we're talking about the FA Cup specifically at the moment, there is an element of fairy tale to it, because I think, and this leads on from what we were discussing about Newcastle as a club, as an entity with its lack of philosophy. I think it's a priority at Leicester to win a trophy to honour the memory of the owner who tragically died in the helicopter crash. And I think Brendan Rodgers was under a bit of pressure for not understanding that in the way he treated the domestic cup competitions after his appointment. He was putting out weakened teams and didn't seem to be giving it that sense of priority. And I feel like it's finally, you know, sunk in the way to, I don't know, cement his status as a successful manager at the club is to win a trophy. So I think, and that's also relevant because Manchester United went into the game looking like they didn't really care. I mean, their lineup their lineup did not scream, this is important to us at all. Whereas Leicester, perhaps they had fewer choices because of injuries, but you know, their attitude and their lineup and commitment to the game was one of this really, really matters. And I think there's a sort of a holistic approach going on. It is a very avuncular club, Leicester. There is a sense, you know, there are no fans in stadiums. So the clubs that can maintain that relationship to the supporters and make it mean something are the ones who are going to do better. And I think Leicester are one of those clubs. So you get the sense with Leicester, it's really strange. The fans are not there, but you feel like they are. And there are some clubs you go to in the pandemic where you just feel there is a huge disconnect. And it's nobody's fault. There aren't any fans there. And you could be watching anything with any context. But with Leicester, it's different. They somehow managed to maintain that sort of family feel. So I think they are the real deal in the FA Cup because I think they all on the same page and they want to do it because they feel they have to do it to honour the owner who died.
The real deal in the FA Cup, says Alison. Matt, what about the Premier League? Is this a top six team to stay there?
Well, I mean, they've got a decent chance of finishing top four, haven't they? And you know, I think the way they're sustaining, obviously, we saw the drop-off last year, you know, and that's the question mark hanging over them. But, you know, form sustains, you know, Fofana continues to be one of the, you know, the absolute finds of the season. Tielemans is, you know, you look at the central midfield of United and compare it to Leicester's and are completely embarrassed. And, you know, says everything for Tielemans' ability, but also, you know, how he was missed by United before. I mean, it's just there, you know, Iheanacho comes in and, you know, shows that they're not just a Vardy team. He's been showing you know, great form. So I think those, if they've got, you know, players like Iheanacho coming in and meaning that they're not as susceptible if a Vardy needs a break or was to get injured or something, then that does give hope that they're not going to go through the collapse, the sort of late season collapse that they had last time.
Let's leave the discussion about everyone's favourite second striker, apart from Alisson, Radkalich, Iheanacho, for a moment, Gregor, because I don't want to upset Alisson by making out he's anything above Olivier Giroud once again. I've learnt my lesson with that one.
me too.
But what do you think? Look, we've spoken about Leicester in the past. You know, we mentioned the squad before, and I think that's the thing that a lot of people latch onto, the recruitment, and they say they're better prepared now, and we did that in the past. But actually, are they a better team, better football team, year on year?
I think so. And I think one of the biggest things in recent weeks is we're seeing players who have... I tuned into Brendan Rodgers' press conference last week and he was asked about Iheanacho and how somebody who signed in 2017, I think, has been kept happy enough to be on the sidelines and be this bit part player for so long. And he's saying it's the way you communicate to him and tell him that he, you know, how much value he is to the club still. And I think we're seeing that with the way that Albrighton's come in, the way that Ayoze Perez has come in, the way that Iheanacho clearly has come in and played like this. And then, you know, the broader question of their squad in terms of they lose Pereira right back and Albrighton plays right wing back. James Justin, Castagna comes in at left back. That back three, the back three... When you compare it to the fact is, well, this is the other thing. I think you're always saying, is this a fairy tale? I think we still also have to just remember how heavily things are stacked against Leicester. They were playing against a team whose revenues are more than double in Manchester United and who, you know, they lose a player every single summer. And Harry Maguire was the glaring kind of example of that. And I don't think Harry Maguire gets in Leicester's team now when you look at their back three. An £80 million sale I don't think, you know, they have improved their defence since he's left. When you look at Fofana, Soyuncu and Johnny Evans. You know, they've got the eighth highest wage bill in the Premier League. I still think they are punching above their weight. And a lot of that is because of, as of, you know, in contrast to so many clubs we talk about, is the kind of holistic approach and vision. And I also think that they're one of the most kind of versatile and adaptable teams, because, you know, when they lose Barnes and Maddison, they go two up front. And Iheanacho and Vardy are playing brilliant together, and Iosi is the one in behind, and they go three at the back when they have injuries to certain defenders or certain players. So they've been very flexible, and they're flexible within games too. You know, they started so high press against Manchester United, got in the lead, and then they can sit back and play in the break. And they're, you know, I think they kind of, although it's no longer a fairy tale, I think they are year on year, the kind of incremental steps they are taking, this is the way of kind of bridging that, what is still a huge cavernous gap between clubs who have decades of Premier League and European football and that kind of status. They are doing that year by year, and I think, yes, they are going to be a team that are regular in the top six.
And on the fairy tale, I mean, it's worth remembering that they are exactly the reason that the top clubs are trying to change every rule they can.
Exactly.
to crush the fairy tale. I mean, it's, you know, we should absolutely agree with everything that the Gregor says and put extra stock in it, because, you know, there are big forces at play here to stop it happening, you know, so that, you know, a Manchester United and Arsenal, Liverpool can leapfrog them if on European places, etc. So it's, you know, we need to not only treasure them, but realise that because of what they have done, obviously with the famous title win, but even this season, if they do finish top four, these are forces that others would kill. So, you know, it's all the more reason to say to cherish what they're achieving.
A team who have got double the revenues, who are Manchester United, who they sold their best player to for 80 million quid. They comprehensively outplayed them, and they're a point behind them in the Premier League. And, you know, it's no longer like that big of a surprise. I still think that's pretty incredible. And, you know, how much the odds are stacked against them. They are kind of year on year, they're getting closer and closer to being among those teams fighting for the top. No, you're not even just the top six, the top four. They're fighting for the top four every year now.
They've lost their best players year on year as well. But just reflecting on Manchester United, Alisson, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer says it's in the manager's job description at Manchester United to win trophies. And you were talking about your football dreams earlier on, and I just started daydreaming slightly during that FA Cup match yesterday. And I imagined Brendan Rodgers in the dugout instead of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer leading Manchester United. I know I shouldn't have, but it was just too tempting. Is that the sort of job he might be taking in the future? Can Leicester stop him from going somewhere like that?
No, they can't, because he's really ambitious. I think he's the most nakedly ambitious manager we've come across. Even, I don't know, there's just something about Brendan Rodgers and his ego that won't quite, you know, hide under the surface, no matter how good a job he's doing. I think he will move on earlier than Leicester would like him to, because he sees his destiny at a traditionally recognised big club. So they may as well just get him to win a cup now before he goes. This would be my advice, rather than thinking they can plan for the next 5 years of a Rodgers Leicester dynasty.
That's Leicester's biggest. That's the biggest risk to their kind of progression, undoubtedly. Because I agree, I think within the next year, you'll see one of England's big six clubs coming for him, and he will deserve it too. Because outside Jurgen Klopp and Pep Guardiola, he's the next best in the Premier League from my point of view.
In terms of some of the managers who've been at Leicester in recent times, though, Matt, maybe they've taken a step up in terms of their recruitment in that area as well, because even if Brendan Rodgers did leave Leicester, you imagine that the new man or woman that comes in would be an incredible talent compared to the likes of Claude Puel or Nigel Pearson or even Claudio Ranieri, for that matter.
Maybe, but yeah, it's a, you know, change of manager can always be a big disruption. And also, you know, if Brendan was, Rodgers was to leave, you might signal to up and, you know, ambitious, upwardly mobile players that maybe it's, you know, that's when they start questioning as well. You know, is it time for me to try and get my move to the traditional bigger club and obviously to get more money? That's a small matter as well. So, you know, I think that's Leicester have, yeah, I mean, the risk of getting a post bag from Leicester, I mean, yeah, we are celebrating what they are doing, I hope, but it's the real world. Gregor mentioned the turnover. That puts a limit on salaries. You know, if you want to earn the top money, chances are you are going to have to end up at a Man United or otherwise, even if as a team there, we're put very much in their place by Leicester.
Speaking of manager egos, let's move on. Jose Mourinho, he was brought to Spurs actually to win trophies, wasn't he? He was chucked out of the Europa League pretty unceremoniously last week. He lost a 2-0 first leg lead against Dinamo Zagreb, knocked out 3-2. Great game, thrilling hat-trick, but of course a low point in Tottenham's season. They did though beat Aston Villa 2-0 to move up to 6th in the Premier League this weekend, 3 points off a place in the top four. They're already into the EFL Cup final. Matt, could they have the best bad season ever?
The best bad season ever. That's a good, right. I just need to spend 5 minutes getting my head around that. never cease to be amazed. I mean, I thought a couple of months ago, the Spurs were actually going to have a decent season. I mean, well-versed and long-standing issues with bits of Jose and what he stands for and how he sets things up and his wider ethos. But actually, you know, as they were when they were flying and he was getting a team to graft for him, I actually thought they would have, you know, a smoother season than they're having. And, you know, I'm still trying to get my head around even that performance last week because it was so... inept. It was so lacking in spirit it's, as Mourinho said himself, no excuse. I mean, it leaves scars. So I think trying to work out the trajectory isn't easy. I think, they're in a cup final. They're still competing right up there. I don't think they're going to get top four because I think Leicester are looking good enough and I think Chelsea are a better team. So I don't think they're going to get top four. They might finish fifth. You can see them getting ahead of West Ham, but I think they are going to finish outside the top four. Some of the reports last week suggested that in itself would get Mourinho the sack, but if he came fifth and won a cup final, albeit against Man City, so good luck with that. That's not a bad season, is it? What was the question? Bad, a good bad season? Finishing fifth and winning a trophy.
It was a good question. Yeah, it might be the best bad season ever.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, everyone's perceiving it as being terrible because we thought they were going to challenge for the Premier League title, but they could win a cup. They could conceivably finish in the top four.
Yeah, but still, the atmosphere is just awful, isn't it? It's like, I've just been really bemused by all this kind of, all the soundings coming out of the club in the last week in terms of, what was he going on about having 2 16-year-olds on the bench or whatever? You know, as if this is like this is such a big deal. Like, I know he picked a strange, you know, a slightly unexpected team and he gave Tanganga a game and Rodon and, you know, he was basically, you thought he was saying that these guys definitely really care. I can have no doubt.
You're talking about the Villa win. Seven, yes. Changes made. Tanganga started, Joe Rodon, yes. and others.
But then he was also kept highlighting having kids on the bench as if, you know, these guys who, if they have 1 minute on the pitch, it will mean everything to them. So he's basically saying that if people who aren't that age, you know, they're seasoned pros, they're not really part of it, they don't really, maybe they were saying they don't care, I think, kind of in an underhand way. And that basically comes back to what Hugo Lloris said as well. There's people who are not all kind of, we're not pulling in the same direction anymore. And so clearly there's unrest, and disharmony behind the scenes. So in midweek, I thought this was the beginning of the end, actually. That was my kind of instinctive.
Same.
I thought this was the beginning of the end for him because when it's the same old battle, if it's between the players and the manager, and there seems to be a divide now, the manager always loses. I still think Mourinho's time is coming to an end, actually.
Are you saying a 2-0 win against an Aston Villa team who looked incredibly flat without Jack Grealish is somehow changed the narrative at Spurs? I mean, that's ridiculous short-termism. The fallout from going out of the Europa League it's just phenomenally dreadful. And that 7.5 minute diatribe from Hugo Lloris, who is, you know, he's almost Mr. Spurs. He's been there so long. He's the captain. And the things he said that you never say. Okay, he might be going to PSG and he might not care anymore. But you don't say those things unless you're really, really getting upset with the way the club is fractured. Training doesn't. I mean, it seems to me you've got people in training trying hard if they think they're going to play, and you've got people in training not trying very hard if they're not going to play. You've got rumours that there are some players still haven't quite got over the fact that Mauricio Pochettino isn't there anymore. You've got Mourinho refusing to take responsibility for anything that happens. It's like he talks as though he's parachuted in as some sort of management consultant, and he's giving an assessment from afar. Oh yes, I can see we've got a team here who might occasionally play well, but they can't play well just because it's a reaction to a bad result. They have to learn to be brilliant all the time. That's his job. That's down to him. It's not some external force that he's playing with. The reason the players seem to be on this sort of up-down, you know, results-wise, or they're top of the table and suddenly they plummet, and then they go back up and then everyone says, oh, we overreacted, it's all fine. It's down to him. It's down to him. He was brought in as one of the world's most experienced and successful managers to get to grip with a group of players who don't seem to have the belief that they're at a club that wins stuff, and inject them with that, you know, that special Mourinho magic, which says, yes, you can win. You can win anything. And they don't seem to be, there's no team spirit. There's no camaraderie. There's no sense of, there's cliques forming. And he's just incredibly lucky that he has some very, very talented players that can make sure that they score the goals they need to get the points to make sure it's not an utterly ludicrous season. But I don't think you can. I really don't think you can think the 2-0 win over Aston Villa negates all the vitriol that came after the North London Derby defeat and then the Europa League.
I absolutely defeat. Don't. But I just think that he was willing to play younger players and to kind of jettison some of the experienced names that we can now infer. And we knew already that we have a bit of an attitude problem, or he perceives that at least. So that means that there is, I think we're seeing a line drawn in the sand. I don't think he's going to want to use these players going forward. He'll want to have a bit of an overhaul, and they're never allowed to do that. So I think his time's coming to end. Also, his pre-match interview was interesting in that he was saying, you know, he was asked about, is it important you see a reaction? He's saying, well, look, I'm of a school, again, as Alisson's saying, separating himself from the players. I'm of a school where every game is like, you know, so important, and you're fighting for every single game. You know, not everyone is like that. And so part of that's maybe true. There, you know, not every player is like that. Not every manager is like that. Mourinho is a winner, whatever you would say about him. But as Alisson says, it's his job to recognise that and try and get the best from them. Just saying to them, you're not, or even saying in public, you guys aren't a winner like me. You know, you've not got it in you to be every single week, every minute of every day on it and a winner. Saying that to them is not exactly going to get them to play their very best football, is it? So whatever way you look at it, Mourinho, like Steve Bruce, is a hindrance. He's a hindrance to, he's not helping Spurs now. His presence at the football club, I don't believe, is helping them.
I think we've, you know, long disputed whether his methodology, you know, and basically, you know, you have the ball and we'll soak it up and smack on and try and smack you on the break is, you know, whether that's sort of out of time. I think, you know, we talked even when, it was a double-edged compliment to Spurs when we talked about when they were playing well and, you know, certain games you had Harry Kane, you know, defending on the 20-yard, you know, 20 yards outside his own goal and dropping deep like that. On the one hand, it was like, wow, look at these, you know, he's got star players working incredibly hard for the team. On the other, it's like, well, you know, how much work like that does a Son or a Kane want to do? You know, they want to play football. They want to show their strengths. You know, how much, if you're asking top players to sort of sacrifice a lot of their strengths to do that, I think it does have a limited shelf life. It always will have a limited shelf life. I just didn't think the shelf life would be as short potentially as it's proved, but that's maybe, again, it's just like, you know, Mourinho is so aggressive in his man management that's what winding up players. I mean, we've seen it with Eric Dier. I think it's one of the most fascinating things. I mean, I was under the distinct impression that he was a sort of become a real Mourinho loyalist, part of the sort of senior group that had sort of bought into it and was sort of fully on board. And now, you know, he looks like one of the ones who's been jettisoned as you know, sort of, you know, one of the bad guys, and there was, you know, a bit of niggle in the press about that not so long ago. So I think, you know, you see someone like Eric Dier, if that's gone sour, then, you know, that sort of underlines the point that Gregor was making about, you know, when you start getting that sort of niggle among senior players in changing rooms, that starts to cause big problems for a squad.
Just to say, I think you may be right, though. You know, I think Spurs do lack players who are real winners. But it doesn't, as I go back to it, it doesn't really matter. You can't, it's his job to get the best from them and to motivate them and to make them perform at their best as often as he can. And just kind of highlighting their flaws. And there's character flaws as much as, you know, professional football and skill flaws, things like that. That, you know, it's just bizarre. I think he increasingly looks like a kind of figure from the past, and the figures he associated himself with in the past, his players that were these warriors, they don't exist anymore, but they're few and far between. Football's changed.
We'll see if Mourinho the magician has suddenly become Mourinho the mediocre in the future. We'll see if they get into the top four as well. Could be a massive end of the season for him and the club as well. Remember, if you enjoy the podcast, you can rate us, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast from. Also, make sure you're subscribed to The Times and The Sunday Times so you don't miss the next episode. At the moment, we're offering you 50% off a full digital subscription for the first 6 months. You can stay well informed on our latest episodes and get the latest from our expert sports writers as well. Click the link in the description of this episode to get started.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There is big news today for women's football. The BBC will show the Women's Super League on free-to-air TV for the first time in a landmark 3-year deal. 22 live matches on the BBC, 44 of them on Sky Sports. This could be massive for the game. I know I've spoken in the past about capitalising on some of those incredible names that have come across due to the COVID situation to play in the Women's Super League. And Alison, this for me is doing that. What do you make of today's news?
It's going to be amazing for women's football. It's not just that it's free to air. It's the packaging you get with Sky. It will make it... it'll feel like part of the elite sport family. And you might well get families thinking, you know, looking at the fixtures, what they can watch together, and thinking, oh yeah, we'll watch that Premier League game. And then, oh, before that, we've got, you know, Chelsea v Spurs, the women. That looks tasty. And it, because it will be given the proper packaging, you know, you can guarantee Sky won't do this. You know, the most boring men's games are packaged as super, super, duper, duper amazing Sunday, blitz, blitz, blitz. So they will do this for women. They will draw you in whether you like it or not. No matter how prejudiced against women's sport you are, you will be sucked in. If you're a sports lover with a Sky package, you will be sucked in to thinking, I have to watch Chelsea women because there's something amazing going on. And then once you've watched it and you are impressed, because the product has to match the hype to some degree, then you might get into the rhythm of thinking, yeah, I like this. And that then snowballs, doesn't it? Because then you get more sponsorship, you get more income, you get shirt sales, you get the whole caboodle. And the reason I'm really pleased about this deal is that it's just a beautiful journey, because I've always maintained that women's football was not served well by being shown on TV too soon. The BBC showed the odd women's game before they were ready for the public audience, and that the audience were curious and they tuned in and they saw substandard stuff. And I think that set back women's football. People thought, oh, I don't think they play well, women. I don't like it. And they were right to say that. There's been a lot of learning going on in the last sort of 16 years or so of just English, British players getting to grips. You don't get so many ridiculous scorelines now where it's all one-sided, or where there's only one team that can play. On an international level, you get really quite beautiful, competitive, wonderful football with tension and that sense of, you know, there's a world here with different roots. You know, the Americans are just so impressive because they've been at it for so long and they take it so seriously over there. So I think the packaging, it sounds shallow to say packaging matters, but it does. A good game of football shouldn't be there, oh, well, you know, we sort of felt we ought to show it. It's there if you want it. It should be given the full treatment, so that, you know, and if it is given the full treatment, it will allow people who are new to the game to get to know the characters involved, the managers, their stories, the players, as you say, Hugh, international stars coming over to England because they see that as the happening place where they can earn a bit of money as well. And once you get to know people's stories and, you know, what they're good at, and so on, you will buy into it. And I don't know. The one tiny side issue is whether people feel they have to support the same women's team as their men's team, or whether it's seen as a separate entity and you can go down a completely different path with it. I think you can go down a different path, a completely different path.
As a glory hunting Manchester United fan, I think Manchester City are going to be right up my street then. Matt, go ahead.
There's a whole new trade in half and half shirts there to be done. I'll just like to patent that now before it goes big. No, I agree. I think a really big point that Alison makes there is about people engaging with the stories of players, because I think this is important, not just for getting the action out there and the match action available, but I mean, I remember having covered some of the 2019 Women's World Cup out there, obviously when England get the semi-final. And I think, again, it was important because people start the profile of that. And I think it was, 11 million people watched that semi-final. It's important because people get to start to, you know, get their favorite players and engage with individuals and start to follow, because I think that is a big way that any sport grows. It's not just a lot of people won't sit down and watch a full 90-minute match, whether that's, you know, men or women. That's, you know, But it is, people will engage in particular stories that they hear about, and they'll want to then understand more about the stories, and they'll start following them on social media, and they'll start reading about them more, and that just grows things bit by bit. So I think that's, the profile has so many benefits beyond just, you know, there's a game on at a certain time. It is because as soon as you start increasing the profile of notable individuals, that has all kinds of sort of benefits across the wider media as well.
What about the packaging? I like that discussion, Alison, around, you know, how it's presented to the audience. Gregor, if Sky Sports is the Lamborghini, what does free-to-wear BBC represent in terms of packaging?
That's a cruel question. Look, as much as everything Alison's saying is true there, I mean, they're saying they're going to get the full Sky treatment, and that's brilliant, and you know, Sky are brilliant what they do. I think it's 18 to 22 games are going to be shown on the BBC in a season. Yeah. A lot of people don't have Sky. That's very important. It's like the best of both worlds. You're getting all of this kind of extra oomph from the Sky packaging and exposure and money, of course. But to keep that, the kind of, if it, you know, a women's game is a kind of fixture of a weekend almost, on free-to-air TV, that's the exposure to a much wider audience is also very important. I also like that there's a kind of 75-25% split to the championship. You know, men's football could learn a little bit from that, and also that the money's going to be split evenly throughout the WSL. So, yeah, like a huge day. But as the guys have said, it's, you know, it's not really about the money. Yes, the sponsorship will increase, and this is valuable additional income for a lot of clubs. Although, you know, I think the amount that they'll get would not really scratch the surface from some of the big clubs' wage bills. The main thing is the exposure, and that's just going to be transformed, I think. So huge day.
The FA say it's definitely the biggest commercial broadcast agreement in women's football. And to be honest, that is massive, because there are a number of teams, whether we know it or not, in fact, the biggest names in women's football in terms of their men's clubs have almost operated on a loss in recent years. You know, they have gone out to try and get big, big names in, but especially with the impact of COVID, a lot of those sides in terms of the women's operation have lost money. So it's massively important that they're going to fill the coffers with this TV deal in that regard as well. But I agree with you. I think free to wear is massive. There are other sports that could learn a huge lesson around getting your games onto, and it's very important to say BBC One and BBC Two specifically as part of this deal as well, not on just on the iPlayer or click the red button. You know, it will be there on a Saturday afternoon on BBC One, and that is huge exposure, we know already, for many people in the country. And I'm sure people will tune into games that they haven't seen before, and there could be a whole new audience coming up for women's football. So a massive, massive day for the game. Before we go, I wanted to talk very quickly around the upcoming internationals. England have games on the horizon, three of them, World Cup qualifiers to be exact. They'll be hosting San Marino later on this week on Thursday. At the weekend, they will go to Albania, and then next Wednesday, they will host Poland. And of course, we will be talking about all of those games in detail. But over the course of those three matches, I wanted to ask you all, which player you think needs to impress the manager Gareth Southgate most, whether that's someone that's regularly in the England squad or whether that's one of the new faces. Alison, what do you think?
Well, I think if he's going to stick, and it looks like he is, with Southgate going to stick with 3-4-3, I think he needs to look... for a start, I think Southgate needs to start thinking about winning and not being nice to people and thinking that people deserve calls or call-ups, and I don't know where that's going. I think he needs to think rather ruthlessly about how he's going to win something, and if he's going to play 3-4-3, he needs to look at Chelsea and how Tuchel has made that, you know, hit the ground running with that, looking really good, which means I think he needs to look at Reece James, who for me, and this is an odd thing to say, and I have no factual basis for it, except it's a feeling. Reece James looks to me like an England player. He looks like somebody who could very easily just slot in doing what he does for his club, for his country. There's something about the way he is. He's just very, very solid and quite passionately patriotic and will give it all. So I would say if Reece James can impress over the next few days, weeks, then I'd be very tempted to think I can, you know, if I was the manager, this 3-4-3 can work. I've got Reece James there. He does. He knows how to make it work. And also, you know, you've got that sort of England flavour to Chelsea as well. So if you can generate an idea of replication of what is happening at Stamford Bridge with England, where Chelsea are amazing. Their camaraderie, those scenes when they went through in the Champions League. We always think Chelsea just a club about having lots of dosh, but they seem to engender this real passionate family feel. Anyway, I would say this is the big moment. This is a big moment for Reece James to seal his place.
I'm going to keep that theme going, particularly with international football over the coming months. Feelings before facts. We want a spirited team going to the tournament. We don't care about data. We don't care about expected goals. Who's got the passion? It was all about Gazza and tears.
Do none of you see what I mean? There's something about his demeanour, which I think means he's completely unfazed about anything at all.
I agree. He's a very calm character for someone of his age.
He is England's right back now. Absolutely. I would say it's important now for Luke Shaw because we probably speak again about the formation and whatnot, but he's not going to change it, is he? So there are a few spots. One is with Jordan Henderson being out, someone along Declan Rice, I'd like to see it be Mason Mount, but Southgate spoke a little bit kind of cautiously about that prospect. But the other is on the left, and I think Luke Shaw, he's a little bit more dynamic than Ben Chilwell, and I think he's got a chance of, after being out in the cold, coming straight back in and being England's left-sided player.
Matt, who would you choose?
Phil Foden is a player. I mean, he is still a baby in terms of international football. This is his first season with the senior squad. What's he got? Only 3 caps. And I think with the quality he's got, you know, I just want to see him straight in the starting team, which, I mean, Gregor says, you know, rightly that we do seem stuck with this formation. But the fact is, if he played a different formation, say a 4-3-3, whatever, there'll be at least a couple of positions where Foden does get in. There's, you know, you suddenly start seeing the variety and you're seeing where Foden could influence here or it could move here. If we play 3-4-3, then it's got to be as one of the wide forwards. And A, that's an area of stiff competition. And B, I'm not necessarily sure it's perfectly suited for him. So, you know, I think that's, but, you know, he's shown he can play it and he's a brilliant enough player that I'm sure he can adapt to it. And hopefully the coaches can adapt with him. But yeah, Foden, given everything we've seen of him, given that, say, you know, it's sort of, he just looks like someone who has got the chance to sort of light up an international tournament. So I just can't get enough of him, really.
I think it's a huge opportunity for him as well, given Jack Grealish is out at the moment. Go ahead, Gregor.
No, I was saying, what about you? Who do you think this is a big one for?
Do you know what? There were a couple of players who are regularly in the England squad who I think it's still a massive period for, who you would not be surprised as it comes to the tournament that they're left out. And if they really want to go, I think the likes of Eric Dier, for example, need to be more impressive, particularly as they might not get much of an opportunity for the club the way things are going. I would agree with Matt that Phil Foden, as I say, with Jack Grealish's injury, has an opportunity to play centrally and maybe show just how important he could be to Gareth Southgate in that 23 for this summer as well. But I think it's the fringe centre forward, the backup centre forward, where Gareth Southgate really hasn't cemented exactly who he wants. Danny Ings isn't in the squad this time around, and he's been looked at before. Of course, Dominic Calvert-Lewin is there, but I think it's massive for Ollie Watkins. He basically has 10 days to show in training and whatever match opportunity he gets that he can go to this tournament. Even if he is on good form for his club over the next, you know, 9 games to the end of the season, I think Southgate will take a lot from his interactions within the squad and his time at St. George's Park over the next sort of 10 days. I think it was already between him and Patrick Bamford in terms of this squad. He's been given that vote of approval by the manager, and now he needs to run with it, because Patrick Bamford, as we've seen this weekend, might hit a run of form and that would leave Ollie Watkins out. So if he really wants to go, I'm interested to see really if he gets any game time, and that will all be off the back of how he trains. If he does well at St. George's Park, he will get game time. And if he does well there, you never know. Look what happened with Reece James. Came up from the under-21s. We're talking about him being England's first choice right wing back. So, you know, Gareth Southgate will give you a chance. And if you take it, you know, you never know. You might end up there at Wembley because there's no plane to get this summer. But you know what I mean.
Hugh, I couldn't agree with you more, because if you, Ollie Watkins, everything that's good about Villa, everyone thinks it's down to Jack Grealish. But if you talk to the manager, he will say it's Ollie Watkins, because he does the work rate of two men. He gives everything in every game, in every training session. He will, it doesn't matter what you ask him to do, he will do it. Plus, he can score the odd goal. If Ollie Watkins can replicate that attitude with England, he'll be a shoo-in, because you need players like that.
I'm surprised Gregor hasn't bit back with Che Adams as the new Scotland saviour who's going to terrorise us at Wembley this summer.
Yeah, we spoke about him a little bit last week, and I still don't think he's going to dislodge Lyndon Dykes. He's my idol, of course.
He's back in the goals, Greg. I bring good news.
Whenever he does something with his hair, I think that just gives him a little spur of extra something.
I bring good news for you from Loftus Road. He looked like he's got back.
Run to the Euros perfectly. I love it.
All of these players, I think, are going to have to time their run perfectly. We're going to be talking about the nail biter coming up on Thursday, San Marino against England, I'm sure, on the next game podcast. Thank you for being with me, Alison Rudd, Matt Dickinson, and Gregor Robertson. Thank you for listening as well. Remember, before we go, don't forget we're offering you 50% off a full digital subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times for your first 6 months. The link to get started is in the description of this podcast, or just type thetimes.co.uk/sale/the game to get yourself started. We'll see you on Thursday.
Listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.